everyone. Welcome back. I'm Henrik, and it's nice to speak to you once again. This is Red Eyes Radio. We're marching forward with many of our conversations that we have each week on a number of different topics in order to learn more about them, check out their validity, and the people behind the research. From materialistic-based scientific research to metaphysical testimony of the strangeness of our world and its makeup, we go far and wide and cast a wider net than most in order to learn and to understand. Today we are talking with Russ Baker. He is an investigative reporter and the best-selling author of Family of Secrets, The Bush Dynasty, America's Invisible Government, and The Secret History of the Last 50 Years, which features numerous chapters containing original research on the assassination of John F. Kennedy, Watergate, and other improperly explained U.S. national traumas. He is the founder and editor-in-chief of the news site Who, What, Why, which frequently covers new developments on deep political events. He has been a contributing editor of the Columbia Journalism Review, and he has written for The New Yorker, Vanity Fair, The Nation, The New York Times, The Washington Post, and dozens of other domestic and foreign publications. We are going to begin to discuss journalist Michael Hastings' fiery end in June earlier this year. A couple of more things on our plate today: Syria and the similarities to Libya, NSA surveillance, the Saudi connection, and more on JFK. Well, hi, Ross. Welcome back, I should say. It was a couple of years ago now, but it's good to have you on once again. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
You bet. Now, so it's almost 5 months ago now since Michael Hastings died in that, car crash, we should say, in Los Angeles, and we shouldn't be too specific yet, as we want to ask you more about this, but as investigations have continued and more information has come to light, it's, for example, recently showed through a recent FOIA request that the FBI actually was investigating him or had a report in terms of his reporting, a file, if you will, on Hastings. More analysis of the videos that were available have been coming in, toxicology reports, etc. I wanted to ask you, since you've done some good reporting on this over at whowhatwhy.org, what do you think really happened, and what is the most plausible scenario when it comes to journalist Michael Hastings?
It is a very complex story, and one of my hopes, and I think one of the things we're going to try to do at Who, What, Why, is to stay with these things over the long haul, because, you know, that's a criticism, I would say, of much of the media, that stories are only covered in a moment, and then the public gets no sense of what happened afterwards. So this thing is going to unfold over a long period of time. But the basics of the story are that Michael Hastings was a journalist working for a number of different publications. He was very, very gutsy. He was clashing with what you might call the military-industrial complex pretty brazenly, and to an extent that very, very few high-profile American journalists do or have ever done, and really came to public acclaim or notoriety when he went to Afghanistan, spent time with General Stanley McChrystal, who was running operations there, and for Rolling Stone magazine, and related how McChrystal and his associates were disparaging President Obama and Vice President Biden and so forth. That basically put Obama in a position where he was forced to fire this very well-known and maybe well-liked general. Caused a huge sort of explosion of interest in that. In the ensuing years, he went on to do all kinds of other stories. He was looking at the General Petraeus and what happened to him. He was looking at all kinds of things on the national security front. And one of the things, Henrik, that he became very interested in was the story of Barrett Brown, another person about whom we've written on the site. We can go more into that later. But yeah. In essence, what happened was Barrett Brown was a fellow who was trying to investigate the links between the U.S. security apparatus and private companies that may have been doing illegal or improper things at arm's length from the government. He began looking at all that. He started connecting the dots on all kinds of things, also over to Glenn Greenwald, now of The Guardian, and WikiLeaks and all sorts of things. And in June of this year, Michael Hastings, as we understand it, was looking into what had been going on with Barrett Brown, who is in jail awaiting trial and faces up to 100 years in jail. It's one of the most draconian things, makes the Bradley Manning 35 years in jail pale by comparison. Anyway, he was looking into all this. He indicated that the FBI, was looking into him. He sent an email out to colleagues to tell them to warn them they might expect visits from the FBI. As I said, we understand that. So the FBI, was interested certainly in Barrett Brown. They had been the people who went after him. And now they were looking into Mike Hastings, who in turn was looking at Barrett Brown. So this is what we think was going on at the time when in June, Michael Hastings in Los Angeles, around 3 o'clock in the morning, driving his car down a straight, residential street. The car, sped up, went out of control and, plunged into a tree. There was a tremendous fireball. The, engine was ejected a long distance from the car, and he was, incinerated. The damage to the car is tremendous, and many people, both between eyewitnesses and those who've studied the photos, wonder if this was what you might call a normal car crash or whether there was more to it.
Yeah, indeed. Well, there's a number of things here, obviously, that we could talk more about and get into more detail. When it comes to the car, the car crash and everything else, you guys also have some interesting testimony on your website. One of the guys, I think, that showed up there around 9 a.m., you know, really a couple hours after this had happened and everything. And I've heard conflicting reports on this, and I mean, that's understandable. That's what happens. Either if you see half of it or if you see it from the beginning, sometimes because it's a, you know, emotional thing to witness, it would be difficult to exactly pinpoint how you saw it and everything else. But there's some video of parts of this, and it seems in some cases that some people have reported that the car actually, you know, just as you said, obviously sped up first, but in some reports it's been that the car first caught on fire and then or even a loud explosion happened and then started to really swerve and then later hit the tree. Have you been able to pin down any clarity in terms of this?
We have not. One of the problems with these sorts of stories and in today's internet-driven environment is that there's so much stuff that's posted, and then a news organization like Who, What, Why, which wants to both be fearless and look into everything, but also be extremely responsible. We have to vet all of these things. We have to check them out. And, you know, with limited people and limited resources, we can't check it all out. We do know that there are people who say that they perceived an explosion slightly before the impact. Now, what does that mean? Well, it's hard to say because, as you pointed out, Henrik, there are lots of issues with eyewitness recall. That's a whole a separate area of debate, really, in general.
Yeah, it is. Now, there has been also consequent reports that Michael himself, I guess that the term is that he feared that his car had been tampered with. Anything to add to that?
Yeah, I mean, we did report that, and at least somebody who knew him is on record as saying that he told her that. He was scared. He was stressed, and he was talking about needing to get out of town. Also, I should mention, by the way, that one of our former top national security officials, the counterterrorism advisor Richard Clark, is on record as saying that he knows for sure that it is possible to remotely hack a car now, particularly late model cars.
Yeah.
I'm not an expert on the science on that, and we're still trying to learn more about that. But it is clear there have been enough things coming out to indicate that at least the potential exists to do something like that. And so certainly when you combine these possibilities that there was an explosion before the car hit, if you raise the question of the fact that just normally people don't have one car accidents, there would have to be a lot of extenuating circumstances for that to happen. The fact that he was scared, that he was worried that someone tampered with his car, that he was under a lot of pressure, that these agencies were looking at him, that the military, some people in the military had a long-term grudge against him for supposedly destroying General McChrystal's career. When you put all of these things together, there certainly are reasons to be concerned. Now, on the other side of the balance sheet, there are reports, and we've been speaking with his family, not on the record, but we've been speaking with them to try to understand these things. He is a complex figure, and we do know that he had, over the years, some issues with certain substances, whether it was alcohol or certain types of drugs.
Right.
And, of course, when an accident like this happens, the first thing that establishment entities do when they want to tamp down any kind of speculation is they point to the person's known defects, if you will. And it's quite interesting because somebody pointed out to me that a former top CIA official is on record many years ago as talking about a syndrome where when you want to remove somebody, you look for exactly those things so that when something happens, people will point and say, yes, but he was known in the past to have a drinking problem.
Yeah.
Therefore, that must be the explanation. And so I think it's really important in these situations to be very, very judicious, to not ignore some of these issues about him, but also to accept that we don't think he was drinking and we don't think he was on drugs at that time. And there were all of these other things going on.
Well, indeed, exactly. There's more I want to ask about in terms of the potential hacking, but if we stick to the toxicology report that came out as well, apparently then they said that there was traces of amphetamine, marijuana, etc. He did have a medicinal marijuana card, I think, on him, and et cetera. Allegedly, this was even because of his, post-traumatic stress, what he had experienced in Afghanistan, I believe. But nonetheless, what I read from some of the articles on this was that they still didn't believe that there was enough, to be responsible, I guess we should say, for the accident, amphetamine, et cetera. What's your take on that?
Well, that's right. In fact, the Los Angeles police and coroner, as I understand it, and I did not write our articles on this, but I'm an editor here, and so I have a pretty good following of the details. They did state that these residues would not have been a cause of an accident. When somebody's dealing with PTSD from covering these combat things, and you have to know that his girlfriend died in Afghanistan. I mean, he's been through an awful lot.
Yeah.
That those things would explain why somebody might need various forms of medication. But again, it's not easy to see how any of those things would explain that particular incident. And I do urge people to go to whowhatwhy.org and. It's in the right-hand column now is a couple of things. Michael Hastings' wreck, video evidence only deepens the mystery, and there's some other ones on the site that you can click around or go to the search box and just put his name in there and watch those things. And I mean, that's pretty hardcore stuff. I'm originally from Los Angeles. I know that strip. It's a straightaway. You don't easily go out of control, and if you do go out of control, you don't, normally, I mean, people, drunks certainly do have wrecks, but they don't tend to turn into a spectacular fireball like that.
Yeah, well, there's something different, that's for sure. I mean, about that, the speed that the car, has in the beginning of it, and then, of course, completely, there's no skid marks and like that, no sign of, trying to brake. What's the possibility here, then, that the car has been absolutely just hacked into, someone else has taken over it, and basically just sped up to the point where either he himself is trying to stop it or swerve or do something, or the possibility that someone even steers this car right into it. I mean, if we look at Mercedes specifically, they've actually been one of the leaders in self-driving cars or, autonomous features. They specifically looked into this in the S-Class. I think Hastings was driving a C250 or something like that. But nonetheless, the technology is there at this stage to practically do, to take control of the car, right?
Right, and I mean, I think one of the rationales there was actually for purposes of safety, that if somebody's incapacitated, and of course you have all these things like OnStar, you know, these remote systems, where there are people at some other location who at a minimum are communicating with you, and then the question is if a person's communicating with you, what's the difference between them communicating with you and them communicating with the mechanisms of the car itself?
Right, we had this one lady from DARPA. We linked that up in one of the videos that we did, or some excerpt from that, rather, in one of the videos we did on Hastings crash, and where she basically just talks about very mundane methods, I would say, to actually take control of a vehicle in different ways, from a CD-ROM in some cases, where there's a layer underneath the music that actually, you know, takes control over the car, and then, of course, all these other features that has to do with the wireless systems in the car.
That's right, and so I mean, the possibilities range from something running through the computer system of the car to something simply put in the car, whether it's a timer or something else. And of course, that's an older technology, and that's much easier to do.
Yeah. Now, okay, so we have those things as possibilities there. I guess one of the things we should get a little bit more deeper into is why they really would target Michael Hastings in the way that they did. And, of course, you've outlined a little bit already in terms of his previous work and some of the things that he was involved in. But is this – have you come across any other cases like this before, Russ, in terms of basically taking out someone that you basically don't like, the work that they're doing in this way?
You know, this takes me back to thinking about national traumas involving potentially the security state way back. We've run some videos on Who, What, Why about the Kennedy assassination, one a series that the BBC had run, and there's actually an interview, it's extraordinary, with an American military officer talking about how he was asked, he said, by elements of the intelligence services to terminate a man who had participated in the autopsy of John F. Kennedy, and he refused to do it, and then he read, I guess it was some days later in the paper, how this man was found dead. And, this man is not a crazy man. He's a man with a distinguished record in the military, well-regarded, nothing flaky about him, and there he is on camera breaking down crying and talking about this. And, you know, there are many, many examples where people say that they know of things or they were approached about it. And there is no question that for any kind of security service, their job, or at least their perceived job, is to maintain security at all costs and maintain stability at all costs. And when anybody is perceived as destabilizing somehow, and if you go back to, say, the death of Martin Luther King, we know that J. Edgar Hoover, the head of our national police, the FBI, was constantly talking about how King had become a problem and had to be taken out in one form or another. And so it's not fantasy to seriously entertain the possibility that individuals or entities or organizations that are viewed as somehow problematical for the so-called stability or national security or the security apparatus, that they would become targets. There is no reason to consider that as a kind of an irrational notion.
Yeah, indeed. And Michael Hastings had been specifically outspoken about the recent thing, about the restrictions of the freedom of the press in the U.S., saying that basically the Obama administration was running a war, quote-unquote, war on journalism, and this is basically all across the board within the press in the U.S., from Fox News to MSNBC, and different outlets have been targeted in different ways by the administration. What's behind that, do you think?
Well, one of my themes in my book, Family of Secrets, particularly, is looking at American history over a long period of time and looking at all these different presidencies. And what you see is that presidents, unless they are of a particular stripe and that they themselves come out of that kind of military-industrial apparatus, academic, business, corporate, banking, oil sort of conglomerate, unless they kind of come out of that and are very, very loyal to that, they're already facing a problem the minute they come into office, because there is a pattern of policies and behavior that, whether it was Dwight Eisenhower, a general, or Kennedy, or Richard Nixon, we see all of these people, Jimmy Carter, they all to some extent tried to resist this sort of inexorable process of the same policies being continued that I think can be argued benefit a certain element more than others. And I think you have that in every country, that there are elites, there are circles of wealthy and powerful people and families and companies and what have you, networks that dominate. We have that here in the United States. And so these presidents are limited. And so I'm not a fan of getting into, is Obama a good man or a bad man? Because I think that's essentially irrelevant.
Yeah. Well, I understand that point.
You know, and, yeah. We have an article on who, what, why. I think it's called, Obama. Oh, those strange, it's called something like the strange threats to Obama. I think just type that into the search box. This will come up. And this is about how all these weird things started happening to him when he began challenging the national security apparatus. He wanted, early on, he said, I want to get the American troops out of Afghanistan. And immediately he was, faced with all of these leaks to people like Bob Woodward at the Washington Post, traditional allies of the military-industrial complex, leaks saying that people in the military are worried that Obama doesn't know what he's doing, that this runs completely against the consensus of the, you know, the smart and knowledgeable people. And he was forced, he was very angry, but he was forced by this to reverse himself and to not only not remove soldiers, but actually to increase the number of soldiers. And so you see time and again, he talks about he's wary of getting involved in Syria, but he ends up having to do that. And so, you know, I think that these people, these apparatuses have sort of a life of their own. I'm not sure you're looking at two or three people throughout history that sit together and plan things, but it's a machine that has enriched certain sectors of our society continuously, and nobody really wants to see it taken down. And so when the media begins asking too many questions, there's pressure to push back. There's concern that these leaks could lead to more and more leaks, and as we have more and more leaks, all of these largely invisible agencies are forced into the public glare. They must be held accountable, and that's not consonant with what they see as their role in their mission. They think it's very, very damaging to themselves to be brought out into the light and to be made to explain why they do what they do and how they do it.
Indeed. Well, exactly. It's pretty much, as you said, well-established in most countries in this stage. I think we can return to that later. I wanted to ask you more about Syria, et cetera, what's going on right there now. But what do you think, is there any other something in terms of the Hastings case that could come out that could resolve the questions that we still have about this, to get a definitive answer on this? Is there anything that you think might be actually coming that could help to solve the case, if you will?
Sure. Well, I mean, there was a Freedom of Information a request to the FBI to see what is in their files. Were they investigating Michael Hastings? And the FBI dragged its feet, and they didn't respond in the 20 days they were required. And so a lawsuit was filed against them, and then they did produce documents. And when you look at those documents, what you see is that they had collected a bunch of articles about him, and mostly that's what we see. Whether these agencies, when they release things, if they're even telling us the truth about everything in their files, I have some doubts.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
we know that from Lee Harvey Oswald, that all kinds of things about what the CIA and the FBI knew about him were held back. And, you know, on the Kennedy assassination, another frequent topic on who, what, why, we talk about the fact that there are 50,000 documents related to the Kennedy assassination the government still refuses to release. So in any case, looking, Henrik, at the FBI release here, we see evidence that they were, in fact, looking at him prior to his death. Now, what does that mean? I mean, my guess is they look at a lot of journalists who are digging into areas of concern to the FBI. But it is interesting that if you look at the actual FBI documents, they're almost entirely blocked out. I mean, This is what I've seen throughout my career looking at so-called national security documents. So, I mean, I'm looking at one here, to Washington Field, from Washington Field, regarding blank, you know, and it's a 6/11/2012. So that's already a year before his death. And then it says there's a giant blank, and then it says the originally stated intent of the article, talks a little bit about General McChrystal, and then it says, recently finished reading one of Hastings' articles or books. So they're talking about somebody else was reading about Hastings. What does that mean? Were they looking at Hastings or were they looking at the other person? We don't know.
Yeah.
We absolutely don't know. And this is a huge problem. I mean, in a democracy, you have to have accountability. And that means that our elected officials, members of the House of Representatives and the Senate, they have to ask to be able to look at these files.
No, but it's all national security. That's it. And then they get away with that. They can just redact everything out of these documents.
Well, you see, technically, certain governmental agencies, particularly the oversight committees in the House and the Senate, are supposed to be able to ask to see some of these things. The problem, and here's where you get the catch-22, they are prohibited from publicly talking about top-secret things.
Right.
So they can look at top-secret things. And it's very, very interesting because Ron Wyden, a senator from Oregon, who's probably the most outspoken and I think really quite an honorable man in trying to expose all of these things about the surveillance and everything else, he says that you know, the government's lying about some of these things, because he says, I've seen things that you know, contradict what they're saying, but I can't tell you about that.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, there you go. What does all of this has to do, if we connect it with the larger picture, let's say, and as you alluded to earlier, it could be that Hastings, of course, was working on something, you know, a bigger piece in some way here, but we have the issue of surveillance really coming to the surface in the last few months here with the with NSA. You mentioned Barrett Brown. There's a number of these scenarios. What is happening in the bigger picture right now in America, do you think, with all of this?
Oh, boy. You know, and also, by the way, I should say that Hastings, we think, was also looking at the current CIA director. And, again, that's a subject we've been covering quite a bit on our site, who I looked at the way that General Petraeus, who was the previous CIA director, that he was brought down, you'll remember, in a big sexual scandal with, again, the CIA and the FBI involved. And it's a very strange story. It's not even clear why he had to leave his job, what that had to do with anything. And so all of these players, you know, the man who's perhaps involved in some of these things, when General Petraeus goes down, then he becomes the head of the CIA, the position he's always wanted. He has a long history of very close relations with the Saudi regime, with the oil industry. I mean, there are big, big money things in play here. And I think that's when things sound very, very complicated. The way to simplify it is, in every country, you have those who have tremendous financial and power motives. And, you know, they don't need democracy. Because what is democracy? Democracy is the ability to say what you want and to have some kind of ability to affect your fate. Well, when you're very wealthy and you're connected and you can get whatever you want, you're set. And so your problem is the deck is stacked in your favor. You've already got an advantage. And what you definitely don't want is the majority figuring out how the playing field is tilted and correcting it. And so I think what we're seeing in the United States and also in other countries, including Britain, which is, I think, very involved in all of these things, and to a lesser extent, countries in Scandinavia and the Netherlands, elsewhere, that where their governments have cooperated with the United States and Britain on some of these initiatives, is that we're all being put through a kind of almost like you'd say a constant terrorization, this notion that there are bad people out there in the world who are dangerous to us, and therefore we must turn to daddy. We must give up our privacy. We must allow cameras to be everywhere. We must allow our email and our phone conversations and our tweets and our SMS messages and everything to be scrutinized. for those needles in the haystack, those very, very few people who could threaten us. And statistically, Henrik, if you look at this stuff, even if you take 9/11 and these other supposed abortive plots, the total likelihood statistically that you or I are really facing a threat is so much lower than our stupidly crossing the street while looking at our phone. And they don't talk about that. That just the likelihood is so remote that it's not really, it is worth taking some precautions, but it's not worth giving up our freedoms. And so when you look at it that way, and when you look at the pattern that we've been documenting on who, what, why of the FBI frequently creating to some extent the scare in the first place. In other words, the FBI, the CIA, what have you, knowing, having some kind of prior awareness, connections, turning informants. We've been writing about the Boston Marathon bombing. That's yet another thing we could talk about where there are real questions as to whether the FBI, how well they knew these two brothers before, long before the bombs went off. And so all of this sort of marriage of the cops, if you will, to the robbers, with us being the victims of the whole thing, I think this is the essence of it.
Yeah, it seems to me that people are put into a position of power and influence under the threat of extortion and blackmail. I mean, we had Phil Stanford with us a while back to talk about his book White House Call Girl, where he basically shows that, you know, the mob have people and connections all the way from the underworld, all the way through the red carpet that goes right into the White House. And this was at the time of Nixon. But the problem here is that this is not something that has gone away. This is just how business is run as usual. It's in fact people's perception of what it is like that is the biggest kind of hurdle, because they see on TV how it should be run, or they have an idea perhaps about the, you know, as you mentioned, the democratic process. But there is a big disconnect there in terms of how things really are run, and then what the perception that people have of how it should be run in a so-called democracy or republic, you know?
Well, that's absolutely right. And in fact, you're talking about these big corporations. When you move up and you become a chairman or CEO of a company, your job is to make sure that company succeeds at all costs. And if you don't, you're out. And so it's not a matter of making moral judgments, but once somebody goes to an expensive university and, you know, acquires debts and then maybe gets an MBA and so on and so forth, and then an expensive family and an expensive house and an expensive car, they are stuck. And they're on this track where they need to move up and they need to keep making more money. The more you move up, the more you have to be able to produce the sort of guaranteed profits and the high margin and so forth. And so at that level, it is all about taking care of any threat that comes at you, however you have to do it. And, you know, if one talks to people who run the big companies privately, they will tell you that they I'm sure they won't admit to any kind of crimes, but they don't have to. They know people who know people, and problems are made to go away. There are, you know, certainly politicians enthrall to them, and there are very, very fine lines between people who are the pillars of our society and the people who are willing to commit crimes or things that should be crimes at the behest of others.
Certainly. Now, is there anything more we can say about Barrett Brown, the case there, what actually happened there for those who don't know, and if it indeed does connect with Hastings in any way?
Sure. Well, the Barrett Brown case is a little bit complex. I'll do my best to sort of boil it down. He was a freelance journalist, written for a number of publications, clearly a journalist, and they sort of try to describe him as kind of a hacker or something, suggesting he's an outlaw. But he certainly was a journalist and with a passion, and he did a tremendous amount of research on the growing national security state and the connections between it and private companies, law firms and things that were being contracted and were doing things that the government itself couldn't or wouldn't do. One of the things that he did was someone had hacked into the files of some of these entities and found tremendous numbers of internal documents and then posted them. What he did was he linked to the posted documents, and he also worked with a thing called Project PM, a large group of volunteers that then were committed to look through these thousands of documents and see what was in them, and then he wrote about that. And so in order to prosecute him for this, they basically had to try to sort of implicitly make him out to be like a hacker, somebody who was obtaining stolen property. But the reality is that all of us in the media, we don't pass judgments on who got the material, how they got it, where it came from. We try to assess it. And so on Who, What, Why, you'll see that we have partnered with WikiLeaks in a number of cases where we in no way were involved in obtaining or encouraging the obtaining of documents. But once they are out there, we look at them and we try to provide a public service by contextualizing them, figuring out if they're accurate, and if so, how much or what they mean. And I think that that's what Barrett Brown essentially was doing. But you see, because the FBI, he perceived them as harassing him, and they came looking for his laptop, and they went to his mother's house, and they were aggressive there. And then he became angry at the way he treated her, and then he made a YouTube video in which he seemed to be sort of threatening one of the FBI agents. Well, boy, when you do that, I mean, he just did that as an authentic, I think, feeling of a guy for his mother. But when you do that, now you give them the fodder, and now they can come after him, really come after him criminally. And so he faces a variety of charges from that to the posting of the documents themselves, and literally faces up to 100 years in jail. He's sitting right now in a, I think it's Fort Worth, I believe, or Dallas. He's sitting in a jail cell there. Mm-hmm. And you know, this is the kind of thing that we all should be talking about and we all should care about, because those people, whether it's him or it's Snowden or it's Bradley Manning or something, these are people who don't seem to be seeking personal gain. They took tremendous risks because they felt that there was some public, vital public interest in knowing what the government that supposedly works for us and answers to us, what it is doing.
Yeah, indeed. Now, before we proceed in some of the topics and talk more about Syria and such, what's your, if we can get a kind of a conclusion, I guess, on Michael Hastings, and if he was murdered by people who basically do not want to have guys like that around, what does that tell us about the future of journalism? Is it something that that scares you in terms of how things are being run on this level?
Yeah, well, let me put it this way on the Michael Hastings thing. I'm agnostic as to whether it was an accident or not. I think we need to do more reporting, and I don't think it's responsible to speculate about that. But I will say this. There's no question that his death sends a chilling message to other journalists, that Bradley Manning's being jailed for a long prison sentence sends a chilling message to other would-be whistleblowers in the military, that them saying to Snowden, you know, that they're chasing him around the world, that he has to maybe spend the rest of his life in some foreign country, that anybody who is a contractor for the national security apparatus who provides things. The message is very, very clear in all of these things. You better not break rank. You better not reveal what you know. And I think that that in itself makes it incumbent on us, A, not to become more scared and to comply, and B, to look at things like whether it's the death of Michael Hastings, whether or not he was murdered, to look at the prosecution of Barrett Brown, to see whether they're really just going after him to send a message and to be vindictive. And by the way, I mean, one of the things he revealed that I think was one of the most important was that a private company contracting with the federal government had proposed a plan to spy on Glenn Greenwald, now of The Guardian, mm-hmm. and to try to ruin his reputation. And, you know, right there, I think the public ought to be up in arms and say, we don't want our government and we don't want our tax dollars financing the ruination and the blackmailing of people who are only being patriots.
Yeah, indeed. Regarding NSA surveillance and all of that that's been coming out here in the last few years, really, but more so the last 6 months or so. Are you surprised that people are shocked when it comes to when it becomes known, rather, that they are spying on everything and everyone that they can with their incredibly expensive toys and you know, sophisticated infrastructure, you know, cyber command and all that stuff that's been built up in the last years. When I learned about that, I was like, yeah, that's why they built all that for. That mega center up in Bluffdale, was it, in Utah? I mean, it's like immense infrastructure and you know, billions of dollars are being poured into this. That's what it was designed to do, right?
Yeah, and decades ago I was reading about facilities in England and in New Zealand and other places where they had these, you know, giant satellite dishes that were supposedly sucking in tremendous amounts of telephone traffic.
Yeah.
You know, James Bamford, author of all those books over the years about the NSA, he's known about this. So I think the issue is this. We all do what we can to maintain our if you want to say, our mental health and our peace of mind. And so we tend to put things out of mind when we hear, you know, you could be being monitored or something. You're sort of aware of it, but unless it's being talked about and written about all the time, you as time passes, you sort of let your guard down a little bit, and you figure, well, could they really be listening to everything and so on. So I think the main function, among several of the revelations from Snowden, was to show us, first of all, that indeed this stuff does go on, show in maybe some more detail how it operates, to show us that they have been dramatically improving their capacity and their technological infrastructure for this kind of thing, the extent to which they're able to do this, and also sort of the propaganda value. You know, some of these things reveal how they would say something to, say, Congress that on the surface might seem true until you know more, and then you realize that they're really misleading them. So I think that yes, we you and I say we know all of this, but I think it's a wake up call. I do.
Yeah. Yeah. Before we switch over here later, we're going to talk more about Syria and Libya and also the upcoming 50th anniversary of the assassination of JFK. I think we should take a short little break, but I want to give you some minutes here to talk a little bit more about the websites. And, of course, mention the book you authored. Is it a couple of years ago that came out now on the Bush family?
Yes. The book is called Family of Secrets. That's really all you need to remember, Family of Secrets. The subtitle on the paperback edition is long. It's The Bush Dynasty, America's Invisible Government, and the Hidden History of the Last 50 Years. It's really about much more than the Bushes. It's really about the interconnection of all of these kinds of events in the same way that we're trying here ad hoc to sort of correlate all these connected things. Many of the major things that happen in history are not the way the media presented them. They're not isolated things. They're all connected. Watergate, the Kennedy assassination, the Bay of Pigs invasion, Iran-Contra. When we study those enough, we see the same players and the same institutions involved again and again. Family of Secrets is about trying to bring it all together. Tremendous amount of research, lots of footnotes and documents. That book came out actually, now it's several years, it was 2009, although it was from a great British publisher, and although it has been recommended by major figures like Gore Vidal and what have you, what's in there is quite troubling, and so the major media, the major TV and what have you, did not cover it, and many people are just beginning to discover it now, although it has become a word-of-mouth bestseller.
Very good. And then tell us about who, what, why, and what some of the major areas that you cover.
Okay. So I founded Who, What, Why, which is a nonprofit, nonpartisan, investigative and analytical news site back in 2005, but just very sort of what you might call a quiet start while I was still working on my book. And it's in the last year or two, it's really been taking off. Our goal is to provide people all over the world with intelligent, honest, deep-digging, fearless journalism where we try to figure out the power equation. We figure out why things are happening because we think that a democracy and the survival of humanity itself are dependent on all of us having information that provides us the ability to make the right choices that motivate us to care and to take action. And so we're very excited about what we're doing. We look at a broad array of subjects. We're really open to looking at any subjects of national interest in the United States. And I would say really ideally stories that would be of interest of any sort of thoughtful people anywhere in the world. We are entirely, we don't take any ads or corporate money. We are entirely supported by ordinary people who send us donations or sign up to be a monthly sustainer. We're very happy to have that formulation. We'd love to have more support so we can hire more reporters and open bureaus around the world. But we're excited by what we're doing, and we're really just getting started. WhoWhatWhy.org or WhoWhatWhy.com.
All right, very good. We're going to have those links up on the website. Check out the book as well. We're going to have that linked up. We're, of course, much more to talk about here with Russ Baker. So stay with us, everybody. We're going to take a short break, and then we'll be right back with more. You know, the majority of what we produce, we do for free for everyone to download or stream from our website. You can subscribe to our RSS feeds, and we spare you from commercial interruptions. And we have an ad-free website. You can also follow our busy news section and also Radio 314. And then when you want to hear more, the continuation of most of our programs, the second hour, we have those in our archives at redicemembers.com. Sign up for a membership and get access to all our previous programs, and this includes films, videos, commentaries, and much more. As we proceed with Russ Baker in the second hour, we'll switch over to discuss Syria and the striking similarities to how the situation in Libya went down, with the exception of how Russia responded, of course. We tie in NSA surveillance, the Saudi connection, and then later we move on to discuss the upcoming 50th anniversary of the JFK assassination. We have much more coming in the next few days. On Wednesday, Radio 314 with Daryl Becker. And on Friday, Stephen and Evan Strong from Australia on some pretty controversial claims regarding both archaeological finds and glyphs in remote locations down there and some of their conclusions on those. Check out redicemembers.com for much more. I hope to see you there. Thank you for listening.